Byron Berline, one of my all-time favorite fiddle players, done so much. The stories and the life that he's lived is just impossible to contain within a short conversation. We're going to talk to Byron to go through a small part of the incredible legacy and history that he's lived. I'm very happy to have on Unreal Bluegrass today a special guest, in my opinion, someone that I've listened to for a long, long time, Byron Berline. How are you, Byron?
I'm doing great, Steve. Thanks for having me with you.
Oh, listen, man, I'm thrilled. I'm just thrilled as I look through the list of all the people that you've played with and all the bands that you've fronted. It's like, yeah, this is exactly the kind of person that I want to be able to reach out to, and I'm glad that you're able to do it, and I'm just thrilled. I'm thrilled. I mean, I can tell you this, musicians that I talk to on this program, you know, any of them that get west of the Mississippi, they're going to talk about Byron Berline's fiddle playing at some point if they're instrumentalists. And your name just comes up. You like own the middle part of the state, and then we go to California. It's a whole different deal. But you are a power. You are a power and a legend, in my opinion. That's just the way I feel about it.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Well, listen, let's talk about, because you play with so many bands, and I don't want to take them through mechanically, but I want to get, you know, I know for a fact you played with Bill Monroe, but I want to, before you start doing that in the mid-60s or 67, let's talk about, number one, you're a fiddle player, how you got into playing, and we'll just kind of see where that goes.
Yeah, well, I grew up in northern Oklahoma, actually born in Caldwell, Kansas, which was, you know, right across the line there, but I was raised on a farm in Oklahoma. My dad was a wheat rancher and cattle raiser, and I was the youngest of five kids, and I was in a musical family, actually. My dad, of course, played mostly all the string instruments, mainly fiddle, of course, and my mother was a piano player, and my other two sisters played different instruments, band instruments and stuff like that, piano. And my other brother played guitar, a little banjo, tenor banjo.
Hmm.
And we always had music in the house, and I just don't ever remember not playing hardly, you know. I mean, I think I learned my first tune when I was 5 years old from my dad. And so I owe him a lot. It was great to have an in-house teacher. And he was a good old-time fiddler. He just played mainly old-time stuff. He liked Bob Wills stuff also. He listened to Bob Wills music, and, of course, he talked about some of the Texas fiddlers once in a while, and eventually we made a trip down to Hale Center, Texas, where I got to run into those Texas fiddlers.
Well, Byron, how old were you when that happened, if you remember?
I was 16.
Okay.
I was 16 when I first ran into them.
And what were some of, do you remember some of the names that you'd heard your father talk about? Who were those guys?
Yeah, well, Major Franklin was his, he really liked Major Franklin a lot. And, of course, Eck Robertson was a big influence on all the Texas fiddlers. And, of course, he was still alive then. And I remember him well. Benny Thomason was another one. It was a great old-time Texas fiddler, and who I got to know pretty well later down the line. And the Solomon brothers, Vernon and Norman Solomon, were really good. Louis Franklin, Major's nephew, was a really good player, and several others, you know, but those are the ones that come to mind. And, you know, my dad played similar, but not near as embellished or improvised as they did the old-time tunes. So, and we didn't have the rhythm that they used a lot. They used, you know, a lot of the passing chords and diminished and so forth, and a guy by the name of Mega Burton was the instigator of that. He was a great guitar player, lived down in Pottsboro, Texas, and he backed up a lot of those fiddle players and passed on that type of rhythm on down, you know, to the guitar players.
Byron, when you went to Texas with your dad, was that so is this a different sort of rhythm that you're being exposed to maybe for the first time? Something different as you're describing it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it made it playing a lot more. You know, it made it, I don't know, it kind of pushed you along a little more than just the open chord. You know, more bluegrass, I mean, more folk or bluegrass
yeah.
type chords.
Okay.
Fairly, you know, they filled up all the holes, you might say.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, Bill Monroe wouldn't like it. But,
exactly. We want to talk. I want to talk about that a little bit because that's a whole different sound.
It was too swingy, but that's what they like down there. And that's why I started learning more tunes and stuff from those guys. Of course, I learned every tune I could from my dad, and then, you know, at an early age, I grabbed the whole of Tommy Jackson records. Patty Forrester had a couple of records out at the time. And that's when we could learn is listen to other fiddlers or listen to records. And there weren't that many fiddles records out there then. That's what you get your hands on, you know. So, but Tommy Jackson, I bought every one of his Square Dance Without Calls. That's what they were called, records. And I had about, they were all Dot records, I remember that. And I bought every one I could find and learned everything I could off of that. And then Howdy Forster records, I learned all those tunes. And then when I met the Texas Dot Fiddlers, it was pretty cool. And they were real nice to me and would show me stuff, you know. And, of course, my dad had a tape recorder, and he'd tape a lot of it, and the contest and so on and so forth. And so that was one way to learn.
We'll stop there for just a second because fiddle contest in Texas, I keep hearing about them because I've not experienced them and not seen them, but it's almost like, it's not quite like football in Texas, but fiddle contests in Texas are very famous. I mean, you know what I'm saying? They're like, that's where you really got to go and buck up and learn and hear. But they're really, they're big events.
Yeah, they used to be for sure, and I imagine they still are. I haven't been to any of them in the last few years, of course, but I know back in those days it was, and you know, mainly Texas fiddlers, and that's still the same way. It's pretty regional. I mean, if you're not from there, your chances of winning anything is not too good.
Oh, really?
I did okay, you know, in my age division and stuff. But it was so much fun just to go and hear the other players play and everything.
Yeah, and the time you're talking about, like you said, you had to buy records, but instead of, if you couldn't buy the records, you could go to these fiddle contests and hear all these different players, these different styles, and start assimilating all that into your own. And if you could remember, you had a tape recorder, that would work out great.
Right. My dad used to love to go to those contests. And that was kind of an event like festivals are today. I mean, at least it was, sometimes there were 2-day events. And it was sort of like a mini festival, you might say, only just featuring fiddle players.
Yeah.
And then the other company must too, you know. So it was a fun deal. And but bluegrass didn't come along until I used to listen to it on the radio a lot. You know, I mean, listen to Bill Monroe and Flat Scruggs on early morning radio, or hear them on the Grand Ole Opry. We could pick up the Grand Ole Opry where we were in Oklahoma.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. How do you get then from what this Texas fiddle sound is, which at this point I think you're saying is leading more toward the swinging, the Texas swing, if I can use that description. How do you get from that to of course, so you hear it on the radio, but is that something that when you heard bluegrass and Bill Monroe and Flat Scruggs that you wanted to play?
Well, yeah. I mean, the first time I ever saw a bluegrass band play was, I was 13 years old. I went to Burlingame, Kansas, for a fiddle contest once again. And Jack Theobald and Buster Jenkins, actually, that was his stage name. Frank Kennard is his real name. And they played banjo and guitar and had a fiddle player. Kenny Plummer would play with them sometimes. And they played Salty Dog Blues and Rolling the Sweet Baby's Arms, stuff like that. And it just knocked me out. You know, when you hear it on the radio and stuff, it's not as impactful as when you see it live for the first time. When I saw it, I went, God, you know.
What was it? When you had that first feeling, what was it of that sound that was really getting into your soul?
It's hard to describe, you know.
Is it the tempo? Is it the tempo?
Yeah, the tempo and the type of music they were playing, and it was exciting to me, you know. Really, it's so neat. And my dad really liked it, too, because he played, his first instrument was five-string banjo. Of course, he didn't do it Scruggs style, of course, but he had all kinds of old-timey ways of playing it with the thumb and index finger. And But anyway, he loved bluegrass, too, and of course, because of the banjo. I mean, that really, of course, the fiddle, too, you know. I mean, put them together and you can't go wrong.
Yep, that's the start of it. All right. So,
that was really, really neat to experience that. And then I knew I liked bluegrass right away, but there was nobody around in our neighborhood or anywhere in our, you know, Oklahoma that I knew of even played bluegrass. And this is in the late 50s or so. And then, but then I got exposed a lot more to it when I went to college. So.
And where was that?
University of Oklahoma. Went there. I was an athlete. I was I loved football, basketball, and track. And in Kansas, you could throw the javelin in high school, whereas a lot of states in the United States don't throw it in high school, but we did in Kansas. I went to Caldwell, Kansas.
Oh, okay.
It was Caldwell.
So and, was it just the college atmosphere that gave you more exposure to bluegrass musicians because they're still in Oklahoma?
It was the college deal because folk music was real popular then.
Oh, okay.
On campuses. And so bluegrass was included in that. Anybody could play anything like that. And that's where I met the Dillards. And they came to the University of Oklahoma November 22nd, 1963.
No kidding. You remember it.
Yeah. That's an important date. A lot of people remember that.
Well, it is for a lot of reasons. Well, sure. But, I mean, it's helps you, I guess, place the date on when you saw the Dillards.
Uh-huh.
And they were so – let's take this a second because I know you played with a couple of the members of that band after the Country Gazette, which I'll just – or right before that. Country Gazette, by the way, probably my favorite all-time bluegrass band. We'll talk about that in a minute. But
okay. The
Dillards, describe the Dillards because they were doing something. They were doing the college circuit, and they got that plug into the TV thing out in California. But they were traveling and really stirring up younger audiences. And maybe you were an example of you saw the Dillards and what they were doing. And they were just such a unique outfit traveling around in that early times of folk and the conversion to bluegrass.
Well, definitely, and they were different than most bluegrass bands because they had the comedy bit going.
Yeah.
You know, with Mitch Jane doing all the MC work and telling stories about the songs and all related to their songs, and it was wonderful. Plus, they were at their top of their game then. I mean, they were really...
They were good. Oh, they were good.
And Doug Dillard was just amazing. I'd never played with a band like that, of course. Somebody had seen, you know, they were standing ready to go on. I'd already played. They didn't hear me play. They didn't miss anything anyway because I was playing with a bunch of folk musicians who couldn't really play. Those deals. But anyhow, this lady said, I just happened to be standing by Doug before they went on. She says, hey, you know, he plays the fiddle. He says, oh, you do? You play old time tune? I said, yeah. He said, I want to hear you play when we finish. I said, okay. I didn't have any idea what they sounded like. You know,
you didn't know they were bluegrass folk, nothing?
Didn't know anything about them. I saw their instruments. Well, you know, we'll see. Their buckskin outfits, you know, their buckskin shirts and white
tees. Oh, yeah, sure.
And moccasins. That's what their wardrobe was.
Yeah.
Anyway, I listened to them. I mean, it didn't take 2 minutes to know they could really play. And I was just blown away by their whole show. And I went backstage, and I couldn't find them for quite a while, and they were at the student union at the University of Oklahoma there, and there's a lot of little rooms, you know, classrooms and this and that and the other, scattered down the hall, and first thing I saw them coming out, and they all had their instruments packed up and ready to leave, and Doug saw me, said, oh, wait a minute, guys, I want to play a tune with this fiddle player here, so you get your fiddle out. So I got it out, and, you know, what are you going to play? I said, well, I have to play some of the fastest tune I knew. That I'd learned from Tommy Jackson. There was a tune called Hamilton County Breakdown.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And so I played it, and Doug got his banjo, and he just locked right in on it. And before we even finished playing the tune, Rodney got his guitar out, Mitch undid his bass, and Dean got his mandolin out, and we sat there and played for an hour and a half.
Oh,
right there,
boy.
In the hall. I was floating on the scene.
I imagine.
I mean, it was this unbelievable experience. And they said, you got to come down to the club where we're playing tonight. It's a place called the Budai Club in Oklahoma City, folk music club. And, that was just the beginning of it, you know, right there.
Did you take your fiddle? Did you go see him that night and take your fiddle down?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I followed him down there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was just really great. And it was close to this time in November. It was right before Thanksgiving. And, I went home. They had another week to play there, and I went home for Thanksgiving. I told my dad, I said, I have to take the tape recorder. Dad, you got to hear these guys. So he let me take it. It was a big old voice and music reel-to-reel tape recorder. So I took it down there and plugged it into the PA system and recorded their shows. And that's when they asked me to record an album with them that following summer, which was a big thrill for me.
Now, which one was that?
It was Pickin' and Fiddlin'.
Oh, okay.
That was the third album. Front Porch was the first one, and Live Almost was their second album.
Yeah.
And then this was Pickin' and Fiddlin'.
Okay.
So.
Well, you got caught up in a hurry then.
I did. Yeah, it was a wonderful experience, and I just really thought the world of those guys, and still do. They did me a big favor, and really enjoyed all that. And of course, that was, you know, from there I was invited to the Newport Folk Festival in the following year, because Ralph Winsler did the album note of that album. He wrote the album liner notes, and which I didn't know him at the time, but then he worked on the staff at the Newport Folk Festival and historian type guy, and he invited my dad and myself and a lot of different fiddlers to the Newport Folk Festival in 1965. Nick Robertson, he invited him, and Arthur Smith, fiddling Arthur Smith, was also there. Some of the first guys I met was Sam and Kirk McGee. Of course, I used to play with Arthur Smith years ago in the Dixie Liners. Tex Logan, I met him right away. And I was waiting to meet Bill Monroe. I couldn't wait to meet him. And Tex, I think it was, introduced me to Bill. And we got to jam a lot where we were, and Bill invited me to play on his show, which I didn't know what I was doing, but figured it out. So it was a big thrill. And that right then, Bill asked me if I would be willing to come play with him sometime. I said, when I get out of school, I'd love to.
So you met Bill Monroe at the Newport Folk Festival, and then you played on his performance during that time.
Right.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And Vanguard recorded all that. That's out on a record now on CD.
Oh, okay.
My dad and myself playing. My dad and I got Bill Keith and Jim Rooney to back us up on our part of the show.
You know what? I know I have bits and pieces of that around, and I know it's been bits and pieces have been, but now I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, that was cool. You wind up going up there, and you get, and then so how long then after that? And Bill says, come and play with the band. Then you finish school, and how long does that take?
It was 2 years.
Okay.
I graduated January '67, and in February I went to visit him at the Grand Ole Opry, and then he still had Richard Green, and Peter Rowan was still in the band, and he thought they might be leaving soon. In March, he called me and says, I'm ready for you. So, I said, so, I don't know how long it's going to last, Bill, because I know I'm going to be drafted in the Army. So he said, well, you come and play as long as you can. So I did, and I got my 7 months with him. Last till September.
Now, had you had any contact with him between Newport and then this, and then finishing school, and you just go back and say, here I am?
No, I'd write him letters once in a while, and we talked on the phone a couple of times.
But you didn't play with him in between that time?
No.
Hmm.
Of course, I bought all his records and tried to learn as much as I could off his records, and there's so many tunes, because I learned all the basic ones, Blue Moon of Kentucky, Footprints in the Snow, Neil Skinner Blues, all those, tunes. But he loved fiddling. He really enjoyed the fiddle, old-time fiddle music, and so we had a lot in common. And we were both raised on a farm, and we hit it off real well, and I really admired him anyway, but we had a great time together.
Yeah,
short time I was with him.
So then you go into the military. Army, you're drafted?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And then when you come out, then was there an Army band then? Did you get to play much in the military?
Oh, I did. Yeah, I was really lucky. Being drafted, usually you're going to shoot a rifle and go to Vietnam. That's just the MO right there. And when you go to Fort Polk, Louisiana, that's a big training site for Vietnam. Yeah, but lucky even have it. I got to play for a family day type thing. They called me at the post there, and this colonel heard me play, and he loved country music, so he told the general, I got to play for the general. and I wanted to be in special services. I was the last one to be assigned special services. And so I got to stay there for the remainder of my Army career.
Well, that's good.
And then I threw the javelin for the track team and put a track team together and the music thing. So I was probably the luckiest draftee there ever was.
Did you throw the javelin with your right arm, bow arm? Did you really? Did you ever worry about throwing your arm out, throwing that javelin?
I did. I hurt my elbow.
Oh, did you?
My freshman year in college, so. But I knew how to cope with it.
Okay.
Know.
Okay. So then you go ahead.
But it was just, you know, it's just a chain of events, and I've just been really blessed to have these things occur, you know, the opportunities come around, and you just take advantage of the opportunities, I guess, I don't know. You know, it's hard to explain, you know, how things happen sometimes, but it's been really good.
Well, I think, like you said, you got to take advantage of those opportunities when they come up, and you were there, and I mean, you did it. So after you get out of the military, then you hook up with at least one of the Dillards again.
Well, it was funny. The day before I got out of the Army, I had one more day left. The phone rang. It was Doug Dillard. You know, I knew he'd left the Dillards, and it was playing with Gene Clark.
Yeah.
And they had a group called Dillard and Clark in the Expedition. Right. And I listened to their first records. I found it or heard it, bought it sometime, I don't remember. I really liked it. And then he says, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm getting out of the Army tomorrow." And he says, "Great, I want you to come out to California and record on our second album." So I thought, well, cool. Mm. And so I did. I judged the fiddle contest. Excuse me, this was 1969,
okay.
June. And I judged the fiddle contest at Weezer, Idaho, right? And then flew right from there, from Boise on down to L.A., and they took me up to the airport, and we was out there 4 days recording this album. I ended up doing a movie score and another couple of sessions while I was there with the people, and I thought, wow.
That's not bad. It's not bad.
Cool here.
what movie score, Byron? By the way, if anyone's tuning in, we're talking to Byron Berline. We're up to the point where he's on the – what movie score?
It was a Burt Reynolds movie called Run, Simon, Run. It's ABC Movie of the Week.
Oh.
Aaron Spelling used to do those.
Yeah, I remember.
And a guy named Murray McLeod. Is this weird or not? I mean, he says, this is what happened.
Okay.
He knew he wanted a fiddle player for a certain scene. He didn't know how to get a hold of a fiddle player, so he starts calling up recording studios. And he got a hold of A&M Studios, where we were recording, you know, Herb Albert and Jerry Moss.
Yeah.
Record company.
Mm-hmm.
They recorded the Flying Burrito Brothers and Dillard Clark and who knows who all. And he said, "Yeah, we have one in here right now." I said, "Well," so he came down there.
Oh, you were just there.
Yeah, just there recording with Dillard Clark. And he and I became friends. I ended up doing about 12 ABC movies a week, movies with him. And I teamed up and did a lot of, and that was his very first one too.
Oh.
His movie score, so. It was just one of those things, being at the right place at the right time.
It's funny that that story leads into your further association with the Dillards, because the way they explain winding up on the Andy Griffith Show is not that, you know, it's not exactly like that, but it's kind of like, here we are on TV.
I know. Well, they have a fairy tale experience, too, going from Missouri clear out to California, not knowing anybody.
Yeah.
In just a few short days, they had a recording contract, a TV show, and... and an agent and all this. That just doesn't happen.
It's weird. It's weird. What are the odds of that happening today, I guess, with all the...
Oh, I know.
Probably yeah. Not at all. I had no idea. The movie score thing is just amazing to me. So you got into doing that for a while. And then how did you then hook up with... were you playing with Doug then in the Dillard and Clark band, or when you were doing the movie scores, or did that come after?
Oh, well, it all started at... when I moved out there.
Okay.
You know, I mean, they asked me if I would move, and I was going to go back to Nashville and maybe hang around. You know, I know Roy Cuff had asked me to join his band if I didn't play with Bill. And, of course, if I went back and tried to play with Bill, he had Kenny Baker playing with him, and I didn't want to barge in on that. Bill asked me why I didn't come back. I said, "Well, Bill, I just had this opportunity to go to California, and I decided to go out there." And he said, "Okay, well, anyhow, it worked out. I told my wife, we got married in 68. I knew I wasn't going to go to Vietnam. So I met her in college, and I wasn't going to marry her until I knew I wasn't going to go to Vietnam. And I found out I wasn't going to go, so we got married in 1968 and saved a little money, you know. And when we went to California, we didn't know for sure we were going to stay there, but we ended up staying there 26 years.
That's okay. Well, that worked out for you.
Yeah. And but I had a lot of great, you know, recording sessions with different people and had a good time in L.A., but it got to the point where I thought, you know, Oklahoma kept calling me back, and we had a house sitting here empty, kind of sitting there. So I, 94, so I decided, I think it's time to head back to Oklahoma.
Byron, for all that time, you had a house back in Oklahoma?
Yeah, well, I had a farm that was given to me for my parents.
Oh, okay.
Had a house, okay. But then nobody lived out there. But my wife had a house right here in Guthrie, Oklahoma.
Okay.
That was deeded to her. And it's a really nice place, and so it was, that made it pretty easy to move here.
Well, but
it's a really neat place.
Well, yeah, and before, okay, so you're in California, and before you come back, though, plug me into the Country Gazette, how that came together.
Okay. Well, after I played, see, Gene Clark left, Dylan Clark, he decided to leave because he didn't like to fly, and we were, and Doug and I were playing more bluegrass, probably a little bit more than he wanted to do, and so he left the band. So Doug and I got a hold of Roger Bush, who was with the Kentucky Colonels, and Billy Ray Latham. We needed a guitar player, and Billy said, I'll play guitar. And so the four of us teamed up for about a couple of years, or at least. And, you know, played around, did a lot of stuff at K-Star in Vegas and different places, and played around all over the, you know, California. And Roger and I, when we tried to leave Doug, we said, well, we need to keep this going. So we knew we needed a guitar player, tenor singer. So we asked Chris Tillman if he knew anybody. He said, yeah, this guy named Kenny Wirtz. He think he's washing dishes in Lake Tahoe. So we found out where he was, called him up, and he said, yeah, he'd come down, and he'd try to play with us. So, and by this time, Herb Peterson had left the Dillard. And Billy Ray Latham went over and played with Dillard. So Herb was available, and so he was playing a little banjo with us. That was the earliest. We didn't even name the band Country Gazette.
You okay.
Know, I think my wife found this name in a crossword puzzle type deal or somewhere. How about Country Gazette? So I called up Roger. What do you think of that name, Roger? And he goes, I like that. Let's use that.
Okay.
So that's how it started. And then the Flying Breeder Brothers, Chris Tillman, they were on their tour where they recorded Last of the Red Hot Breeder Brothers.
Yeah.
And he asked Kenny Wirtz. He needed him. Of course, Bernie Litton had already left the band, and so he needed a banjo player. See, bluegrass was going over really well then with the Flying Breeder Brothers show. They do their country rock stuff. They lay all the electric instruments down and pick up the mandolin, banjo, and guitar, and whatever else, and they play bluegrass. And that really went over well, especially in Europe. Hmm. Right? And Eddie Tickner, who was our manager at the time, played me a tape of them playing in Holland. And my gosh, those kids went nuts when they played the bluegrass music, you know. And I thought, that is too cool to have them react like that. So we went on this tour, and they had left Roger at home. Roger didn't go, but the bass player, Roger Bush. And then we found out we needed the bass when we did the bluegrass stuff. Nobody could play bass like we wanted. So I just told Chris Hillman, I said, why don't we just get Roger to come out and play bass? And, okay, so we did. And that's, after that was over, right in that tour, Stephen Stills had us all come in down to Miami, Florida to record this Manassas album.
Yes.
And he liked Tins on Bluegrass also. So he asked Chris Hillman, Al Perkins, who was the steel player and guitar player for the Breeder Brothers, myself if we would join his band.
I refused. Didn't Al Perkins also play with Crosby, Stills, and Nash?
No, I don't know.
No? Okay.
He ever did or not.
All right. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Manassas, I remember very well, and I bought that when it came out, and there's like one whole side of that that's really just bluegrass.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And about this time, when I went back home, well, the Burrito Brothers had a tour already lined up in Europe, mainly Holland. And Eddie Tickner, the manager, said, "Brian, you want to go to Europe? I've never been there." And I said, "Well, yeah." "You have to go to the Flying Burrito Brothers." I said, "We can't do that. We don't have any Flying Burrito Brothers here. I mean, they're all gone. They'll make any difference." I said, "Well, it will." "No, it won't. It's already booked. Put a band together and go to the Flying Burrito Brothers."
Okay.
Oh, man. So we did, and I said, "You know, we need an electric guitar player, banjo player." I said, "You know, I know a guy that I went to college with. I bet he can do it." They said, "Who's that?" And I said, "Alan Mundy."
Got it.
Alan Mundy had just quit Jimmy Martin. I'd heard that he had, so I got a hold of him. I said, "Alan, you want to go to Europe with us?" "Yeah.
Yeah.
I will. I'll play guitar, electric guitar, I can do that, and I'll play banjo, too." They didn't even know him. We met at the airport in New York City on our way to Holland. And at the airport, I said, "Alan, get your banjo out and play these guys a little something here so let them know you can play."
Really? So he had to play for his airplane ticket.
Yeah. And that was the country set that started, you know, cooking in. And we got to deal with the United Artists. And they did two albums, Trade in Our Myth and Don't Give Up Your Day Job.
Mm-hmm. They're both right over there on my floor, Byron. I'm looking at them right now. Those, the vinyl. I have the vinyl, and then I bought whatever I could on CD. But those albums to me were just like, they hit me right at the right. This is not about me, this interview, but that music hit me right at the time. Almost like when you go to a festival, I'm hearing the Country Gazette right as I'm starting to get out of high school into college time, and I'm hearing that stuff, and it really captivated me completely.
Well, it was amazing, you know, that a lot of young bluegrassers that made them get interested in bluegrass music.
Yeah.
And I know Joe Carr, he's one that mentioned that.
Yeah.
He said, you know, first time I saw you guys at Winfield, Kansas, I thought, I love this, you know, so he bought our record, and that's what got him into bluegrass music.
You know, what's funny now? Oh, yeah, sure. What's funny now, Byron, is when you listen to at the time, the Country Gazette was kind of like, you know, maybe innovative, more so as compared to Bill Monroe, but, and the same thing with other bands in that early part of the 70s. But now you listen back to them, you think, that's pretty much straight down the line. But at the time, there was a real invent, and still is, except by comparison, the things that have changed since the early 70s in that period versus now. But I just liked everything that they did.
But Jim Dixon helped us out a lot, deciding what songs to do, and saying, "Yeah, I think you guys should do this song, like Honky Cat," Elton John song, a lot of Gene Clark songs. Keep On Pushing was a hit in Holland. We got up number six over there, and we'd pack every hall we ever played, and people would be scared to sing along with you, and it was just. And all the rest was out there.
Mm.
We did a show in Holland where the Eagles had just started. Gosh, who else was on that? Rod Stewart and Ringo Starr was just the headliners. They got one song apiece. We got three.
No kidding.
Yeah. We thought that was pretty cool.
It's still pretty cool.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I love this.
And once in a while, I'll talk to somebody from Holland. Just, I remember you guys back in the early 70s. And I said, "Well, you're aging yourself now." But that was just a time that they just hit. You know what I mean? It was those kids loved it. And I don't know. If that'll ever come back again or not, who knows?
It caught me up, and that's the term that I used, because that was right in the time, as I've already described it. So there was something going on, and certainly, isn't it odd about the European audiences, how they react to things that maybe don't, you know, that are really good. But over there, they're just like, you're like rock stars. Well, you just described it. Uh-huh. You were a rock star in Holland. Now, I don't know that you ever reached that level here or not, but in Holland, in Europe, you guys were rock stars.
Yeah, it was we got to experience that with all the TV and press and all that stuff. It was, and just to sell out every hall we played.
Isn't that something? Wow, that, cool. I love these stories. This to me is just priceless information. I didn't know these things. This is just great.